Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Just released the Teen Wolf collection, featuring all new shirts and enamel pins, as well as the exclusive shirt and enamel pin for the documentary Haunters, The Art of the Scare. The director of that will be on next week, by the way, which is now streaming on Netflix. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that is SUMMERSHOCK10. Go to www.fright-rags.com now.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA. Coming soon from Wellgo USA, we have three amazing movies. First up is Gonjim. Based on the local legends and stories of people who visited the real-life abandoned hospital, Gonjim Haunted Asylum, follows the crew of a horror web show who plan to stream live from inside the asylum, but encounter much more than expected. On digital, Blu-ray, combo, and DVD, September 18th. Wellgo USA also has Phantasm in a beautiful 4K scan, The Tall Man is Back with a Vengeance. And they also have, coming soon, Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead, Phantasm 4, Oblivion. Two cult classics and Don Coscarelli's legendary horror franchise make their standalone Blu-ray debuts September 18th. Check them out online at www.wellgousa.com. That's wellgousa.com. Boy.
Tonight's show is also sponsored by the film Don't Leave Home. In theaters and on demand today, Don't Leave Home brings to life a chilling urban legend. It's the film critics are calling Get Out with Catholic guilt in the Irish countryside and dubbing an atmosphere waking nightmare. From the teams at Shudder and Cranked Up Films, visit www.don'tleavehomefilm.com for more info. Additionally, Shudder is giving out a free 30-day trial to check out their service. Use promo code STAYHOMESW at checkout. Again, that's STAYHOMESW to get a free 30-day trial and check out Don't Leave Home.
This week's episode is also sponsored by RLJE Films. Find out what's really going on behind enemy lines in the gruesome thriller Trench 11, out now on DVD, VOD, and digital. A deadly disease created by German forces on the loose and spreading fast. Will Lieutenant Burton be able to stop the outbreak and end the war? Find out in this dark world war horror. Gruesome Magazine calls it a cinematic thrill ride. Get Trench 11 on Amazon.com now.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network has launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, Clark Wolf, through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awaits. This week, we are also launching Attack of the Queer Wolves. Join Mark Fortin and Michael Kennedy, along with Nay Bevers, as they journey into the queer side of horror films. Both are available now on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative and Attack of the Queer Wolf.
Lock the gates.
Oh, well, hello. What? How are we starting?
That's how Mark Maron starts his show. I don't know.
Oh,
and then the guitar comes
in. Yeah, and then Boomer Lives. But that's, this is not the Mark Maron.
What? Oh, okay. Well, I thought we were going to get his sponsorship.
Everyone fell for that for five seconds. They were like, oh my God, it's Maron.
Did I start Maron by accident? No, I love my horror
I don't complain like he does.
No, you are listening to Shockwaves episode 113. I'm not dead. I'm back.
Oh, yeah.
Rob Galuzzo here. Rob G, hello.
World traveler, Rob
World
G.
World traveler, Rob G. I'm with Elric Kane.
Hey, thanks for that postcard. That's all I know.
What was it?
Well, I talked about last week at length.
Oh, you did?
When you weren't here. Yeah, we did, right? I think so.
I listened to the episode.
It was a Heinrich. Right, I call it a Heinrich poster. It technically it's Possession, but really it's Heinrich's movie.
Yes.
So
Possession postcard. I also got a postcard out to Rebecca McKendry.
Mine had Jason Statham on it.
Can't go wrong with the Statham.
Hell yeah.
Which movie was it, Crank 2?
I have no idea.
It was him with the gun. I mean, it really could
bank,
be
the
any.
Bank job. It would have been the bank something.
Are you sure about that?
Are you sure?
I defy you to identify what what movie it is. Him, it is a bald Statham with a gun.
But he's also well dressed, right?
Gun. No, he just was wearing a button down shirt with the top two buttons unbuttoned. Again, every movie.
Every movie. I don't know what it was.
You could
Statham.
Pick it up. Okay, you could have told me it was Crank 2, and I would be like, okay. Yeah.
Whoever writes in with the correct Statham will get something.
Check Becca's Instagram.
Tweet it, Becca.
It's on my Instagram.
Yeah, it'll say on the back of your card. Which
oh, it will?
I hope.
Turek got Karloff. I hope it arrived by now.
Okay.
But Karloff is universal, and that's what I wrote on the back.
See, does Turek really need anything now that he is Halloween?
No.
Does he even need a postcard?
In fact, he's not here right now. Becca almost wasn't here. You made it in the nick of time.
Yes.
Because I was going to say, we're the Beatles basically in our White Album phase where we can't even all be in the room together. We have to record
which is one of the better albums. Pretty good album.
Turned out to be a great album, but man, there was some tough times right there.
You know, guys, we've been doing this for so long, like the Beatles. We don't even have to be in the same room. I feel you guys' presence no matter where I'm at.
Sure.
Number nine.
You know, go back because we might not have all been in the same room when all four of us were on a show. No, I'm just kidding. No, I was just saying.
Oh, yeah, that's true. We're all off Skype.
I can't be in the room with Elric while we do this show anymore.
Yeah, we haven't reached that. We've had those moments in our time, but I think lately we're all fine.
Yeah, we're good. And I had a nice little break, so that helped tremendously.
But congrats to Ryan, who isn't here, because early word of Halloween is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, it could have gone that you never know with remakes, you know?
Yeah.
We haven't seen it yet. No one here has seen it.
And he's at a premiere tonight for a completely different movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
So he's just all over the place.
Yeah. Congrats, dude.
Well, bully for
him. For being so busy.
Yeah.
Actually, he's the one missing out this time because today, all things go well, and our guest appears in this room. This is one I've wanted to do since early Killer POV days.
It's true.
This is a name that's come up so many times, and I remember when VHS movies were being made, the VHS 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The person, every time I would see Brad Muska, every time I'd see him, I'd be like, the only person you need to get to do one is XYZ, our guest. Which won't be a mystery by the time this airs.
Yeah, well, you'll see the photo too. Yeah, so, well, if he shows up, that's
if he shows up. So if he doesn't, we won't.
There's still a gamble,
but he's just someone who I think is very visually inventive and interesting. So this should be fun.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I have a lot to
start with. You and Fright Fest.
Yeah,
we don't know what you did.
Fright Fest.
Yeah.
Wow. Man, how candid do I get?
I want to hear the nitty gritty.
I went to London for Fright Fest, and then I went to Paris for vacation, and I...
Let's go to the vacation part. What'd you do on that vacation?
Yeah, really, talk about the vacation.
I'm on a vacation, sure. So I spent a lot of time with my my lovely girlfriend
in Paris. Holy
cow. What?
Wait, this just got real.
That hasn't been announced on show yet.
And we watched a lot of movies. We got to see, she was with me at Fright Fest, so we saw a ton of movies there, and then got back. We saw Psycho. I heard you talk about it yesterday. Like, I love you guys to Paris to watch Psycho 2
at home. Yeah.
Well, it was one of those things where, so basically every day I'm there, like, it's a thing that everybody walks around with bread, like fresh bread, you know, whatever. And I was like, I want to be one of those douchebags. I gotta do the bread thing at some point. And so we got out of seeing Psycho in the afternoon because it happened to be playing. Actually, here's a funny thing. You would have loved it, Elric. It felt like a scene from a movie because we go into this little revival theater that is showing it, and it's like a tiny room. It felt like a scene out of a movie. It's a tiny room with giant red seats. Three or four of them are like taped together because those are broken seats. There's like scattered like maybe five people in there. We get our seats, and the lights are still on, and I hear music playing. And then eventually the movie starts and the lights go off. But as the music's playing, I turn to Alyssa. I'm like, this is the DVD menu. they're actually about to play the Blu-ray for us right now. I recognize that music anywhere. So it was a Blu-ray where they just put the French subtitles on. But still, good to see it on the big screen, and it looked great. And it, of course, immediately after, like we should get like cheese and crackers and beer and watch Psycho 2. Just seemed like the
beer.
Logical.
Wait a minute, not in France. That's wine.
No, that was wine. No,
wine.
I'm sorry. We drank beer at McDonald's. That's a whole other story. We had wine. And cheese and bread while we watched Psycho 2. So that was lovely.
Nice.
And the other two things I saw, first time watches on both, believe it or not, and you mentioned it last week, Hocus Pocus. I actually
love Hocus Pocus.
Never seen it, yes. And I liked it a lot. I thought it was interesting. I mean, it's a really fun, whimsical Halloween style movie. It's definitely, I love the feel of it. It was hilarious because Alyssa loves it. It's one of her favorite movies of all time. Much like Rebecca, it's probably one of your favorite movies
Come
of all time.
Come Little Children is an amazing song. I find myself screaming amok regularly. Amok.
I liked it a lot, but it is of the time. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know, maybe the effects were a little on the TV side and this mm-hmm. and that. And so I'm on my letterbox right after, and I think I gave it a 3 or 3.5. And there was already almost an incident. I was almost kicked out. Like, wait, what are you doing?
You're not going to
give it a perfect score? And I'm like, yeah. Look, I understand why it's a perfect movie.
You clearly were not a child in the 90s.
I was not a female child in the 90s.
Because so no, this isn't that, a perfect was, movie. That was biblical for us, Rob. There was the craft.
I know. I get it and I appreciate it. So I did like the movie a lot. And, you know, it was like a lot of fun surprises to it. When we talk about gateway horror, things like The Monster Squad and things like that, this definitely falls in that mm-hmm. realm where I think it's a sweet story between a brother and a daughter, a brother and a sister, and the sister is Thora Birch, super young.
Yeah.
I love that the zombie guy in it, who is supposed to be scary but then ends up being just kind of like a quirky, fun character, Billy, is Doug Jones.
Huh.
And I just listened to Postmortem because Mick Garris wrote Hocus Pocus,
yeah.
and he talked about Tony Gardner was the effects guy. He found Doug Jones. Because he was obsessed with this moon-faced guy in these McDonald's commercials.
The Big Mac singer. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, I need to find this moon-faced guy.
Wait, what did Doug Jones do?
He's Mac the Knife. He's the Mac the Knife with the big moon head.
Mac Tonight.
He's the guy, yeah.
Are you serious?
That's Doug Jones.
I had no idea.
He clearly didn't watch This Week in Horror, my first show, like 20 years back when I had.
Who did? This Week.
No, the one before that show.
Oh,
the show before we had Doug, and he talked at length about playing that, and I was blown away when I found that out.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. But that's what happened. Tony Gardner saw that, was obsessed with who that guy was,
wow,
found him, and basically he's the one that found Doug Jones for Hocus Pocus.
That's amazing.
And the rest is history. It leads to everything else. But we immediately followed up as a perfect double feature with The Witches, mm-hmm. which I'd never seen from 1990.
That is scary.
Pure Cinema approved, probably the director I talk about most, Nicholas Roeg.
Yeah. That's the thing.
It's at least Nick Roeg-ish, but it's still awful.
Well, that's
still
a funny thing.
Fucked up movie.
I knew the cover.
Yeah.
But I was like, I don't know if I've seen it. I actually have seen the second half a million times. So once we started watching, I was like, oh, this is really interesting.
Because she's out by the tree asking the kid to come outside.
Really creepy scene.
Total kinder trauma
when they
stuff,
take their hair off.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I'd read the book before.
Roald Dahl in general is
creepy. Roald Dahl, twits fucked me up as a kid.
Yeah, twits is great.
BFG's really scary.
As a kid, it was scary. The movie, I didn't even see the movie because it just looked too big for what my imagination had.
At the time.
It's actually pretty sweet.
What have you never seen?
No, the Spielberg movie I've mm-hmm. watched. Because when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, but that's not what's in my head. Like, you know, it's just one of those things. As a kid, you really get that defined. You know?
Yeah. Well, this one was terrific. And then what happened basically is the witches have a master plan to turn little children into mice.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So the lead characters end up getting turned into mice. That's when I remembered. I was like, oh, I remembered this but I never saw the first half. I just saw mice children that could talk fighting witches. And I was like, what the hell is this thing? But that was like one of those HBO stables. And
they just announced a remake.
Did they really?
Yeah, like last week I opened something on IMDb and they said Roald Dahl's The Witches to get remake. And I can see it getting remake.
Sure. I think so. This is on DVD. I think it deserves a Blu-ray release because like it looks, Nicholas Roeg, it's a really cool little movie.
But it's also interesting, like I'd love to know the studio who gave him that gig because that's such a ballsy move to give a guy like him at that point in his career where stuff's so experimental and sexual, you know what I mean? Especially sexual, so adult. Every one of his films is about adult interactions, and then to give him like this classic kids thing,
and he
pulled it off.
Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed he didn't go on to do more big mainstream movies.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen him have that other act to his career, but he didn't. He really didn't get another. Mm. And I'm sure it did well. I'm sure it was a popular.
Yeah,
movie.
I mean, I always remember it, and even just from my video store days, or even working at Amoeba, like it's one of those that just constantly sells.
Yeah,
that and Hocus Pocus are just constant.
I
got to
see Hocus Pocus again. I must have seen it when I was young, but I have not seen it since.
It's fun, and I
did Halloween movie, right?
Yeah, it's like I love. Iconography wise.
It's actually going to be at the El Capitan Theater here in town mid-October for a couple of weeks, which is for listeners, it's basically the Disney Theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
It's really nice, and they always do really cool pre-shows before it. I've seen a couple of things there and taken Marnie, and they'll always have, they'll either bring like a Muppet out to introduce stuff, or they'll have like people come down and do song and dance numbers. Like, it's a really cool theatrical presentation before the movie plays usually. So I hope they do something fun.
Did you see any like festival, you know, indie new films that aren't being talked about yet?
Fright Fest? Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I mean,
standouts?
By the way, the last Paris thing was, which goes back to Statham, we did go see To the Meg, which over there is called In Troubled Waters.
Oh.
And the movie's goddamn ridiculous.
Yeah, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I had fun watching it, but here's the irony. On the way there to London, because the flight is freaking 10 hours long, I actually watched the HBO 3-hour documentary Spielberg.
Oh, I still haven't watched it. I'm dying to see it. It's
absolutely
been on my
terrific.
DVR.
Terrific yeah. documentary, but obviously they do a big chunk on Jaws. And I think the thing is, Jaws, like, and you know, because that's what is like third movie or something like that, it ruined everything. You can never make a good shark movie. You can never make a movie that's going to be better than Jaws, ever. I would love anybody to try to make a better shark movie than that. It's just never going to happen.
And unless you
that's the
set
weird
it
irony.
In a supermarket.
Which is I like bait 3D.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Bait's actually pretty fun.
But it's no Jaws.
It's no Jaws.
And so there's just no...
Well, also the caliber of talent behind Jaws, like acting-wise, it's like, all right, you've got all these great classical
actors.
Oh,
yeah. No, Statham is amazing in it because he's like... I think you and Ryan talked about it a couple weeks ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And basically he was saying like the situations he puts himself in, like the fact that one of the lead characters is ex-wife, but it's basically there as a joke almost.
Yeah.
Because there is like one of the characters and basically he shows up to be like, I told you so. And then she's out of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, well, see, wait, was she going to be in it
that's
more?
That's what ex-wives do, Rob.
I mean, his ex-wife is in the book, but she is like power hungry and trying to get the news scoop on what's going on.
That's not the
and
version of
she's
this.
She's in the bulk of the book, at least like 50% of it.
Oh, God.
And so it's much more of like she's the one of the antagonists in the book, but that's not in this. In this, it's literally like, I told you so, peace. And
well, so it. Yeah, so basically his ex-wife is there for a joke so that he could immediately have a new love interest,
yep.
which is the other lead character. And there's like an absolutely ridiculous scene where basically she walks in on him when he's getting out of the shower only in a towel, and he's like practically flexing the whole time.
Oh, yeah, you it's can really... tell like he was doing sit-ups and push-ups right off screen, yeah.
yes.
right? Because I mean, like, there's veins popping out.
Yes, and listen, French people do not react at all at anything.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I heard smirks regardless.
Oh, so they just aren't a very reactive.
There's no, it's silence.
Oh wow, no. Yeah, when I saw it in the theater, I saw that one at the theater I love on Victory in North Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like behind the Shady Sears.
Oh yeah, yeah. The Victory,
I love.
Yeah, the Victory,
it's behind
yeah.
the Top Girl strip club. It's like completely yep. buried, but I love that theater because no one's ever there. And so I saw it there, and there was like howls.
I laughed out loud a lot.
Why wasn't it called Le Meg? That's
Le Meg?
Like Le Meg just sounds Le Meg.
That's what we thought. No, like, in Troubled Waters.
What was it called again? Troubled Waters.
In Troubled Waters. That's the name of it there.
That's a good title.
That sounds like a Claire Denis film.
Well, when you see it in French, it sounds way more sophisticated.
That's what I mean. It sounds
But I will say one more. I'm sorry for going on so many tangents, but it's really funny. So I also watch right before this. It's not a horror movie, but it's what made The Meg 10 times more enjoyable for me. Like, had I not seen it, I don't know if I would have liked the movie as much. But literally, like, 2 days before I saw The Meg, I saw the movie Spy, the Paul Feig movie with Melissa McCarthy.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Where she's a spy, but Jason Statham is in it.
That's right.
And I've never laughed out loud harder than at Jason Statham in that movie.
Because
he just plays himself, but he keeps saying all these impossible situations he's about to do. Like, I'm going to jump kick this guy and then just take down this helicopter with my bare hands. And then he goes to do it and fails miserably every time. And so like, that's all he does for the whole movie.
That's good.
So I was like, I can't believe he agreed to do this and make fun of himself. And so like going to one of his serious movies where he says how badass he is and what he's going to do, I just laughed out loud because I kept thinking of Spy. So if you haven't seen Spy, I know it's a side, it's not horror, but it is hilarious for Jason Statham.
And everyone just take a little moment, take a drink. If you're like me, believe Crank 2 is an actual masterpiece. Take
it
a
is. All right. It's brilliant. So, yeah. It's freaking brilliant.
Here's to Crank 2, baby.
Crank 1 as well.
Crank 1's awesome, but
Misuse.
Crank 2 takes you to a whole another weirdness.
I even overlooked the inaccuracies with the EpiPen bullshit.
Okay.
Just to keep going with it.
I'm still
it.
Going right
like,
to your
I'm
heart,
still,
Becca. I'm still
going
to stab it in your heart.
They also don't amp you up like that. Like, okay. It's difficult to move after using one. But in that one, he sprints.
That meant Crank 2 has everything. Crank 2's almost as bonkers as one of the movies we're all going to be talking about soon.
Yes. Well, actually, Crank 2 I saw in theaters late at night, and I kept like dozing in and out of consciousness from it. And so at one point, I had to ask somebody, I was like, did I wake up and did they become like Godzilla versions of themselves and start fighting over buildings? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah,
all right, just make it short.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, kind of amazing. Yeah. Fright Fest. So, I'll be quick about it. I've always wanted to go. It's got such a giant reputation in the genre. I did not have that great a time in London in general. Yeah. I think there was just a lot of, I was just out of sync and I had a lot of miscommunication with exactly what I was going to be doing there as well.
I think that's a line in Snatch. Just talking about David Stone, I think there's a line towards the end where Dennis Farina just goes, got anything you want to say? He goes, yeah, don't go to London or something like that. It's like, it's just one of those memories.
Well, I'm trying to be polite.
Did
about
you at least meet some good shockers then?
Yeah. And that was the best part, to be honest, is I did get
Rob
to meet,
G, is that you?
Yeah. And it was wonderful. And I mean, this
don't
is how
be racist, Elric.
This I'm not xenophobic.
This is how great the Shockers were in London. Was I was actually so nervous about figuring out how to get from the airport to the festival in my hotel that one of our Shockers, Kat June, and her boyfriend Rich met me at the airport and took the train with me.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which I was like, really? You're willing to do that? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And so I was like, great. And so thank you, Kat and Rich. I appreciate. I definitely would have been a little lost trying to figure that all out. But they walked me in. I met so many familiar faces. Sheraton Knott, actually, who's pretty active on our pages and the group, gave me these, which are these Videodrome magazines.
Oh, what?
And this is based on a show that Alex Cox did.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So these are basically cult recommendations from Alex Cox.
That's cool.
In magazine
he's
form.
A guy I would love to get on the show because he lives in LA now.
Does he
went to UCLA. He's a Brit, but he went to UCLA. He made Repo Man and
so this is so just I just opened on one page. This is Alex Cox doing essays on Crybaby and Darkman
and Dead Ringers.
and Day of the Locust.
Yeah, no, I've seen a couple episodes when I was cutting things for Pure Cinema where he would introduce movies.
Yeah, I think they're on YouTube. Cool. You can find them on YouTube and stuff. So that was from Sheridan. But yeah, I met a lot of people and they
most importantly, did anyone give you shit about Inside Number 9?
Zero people.
What the fuck?
Zero
come
chance.
On, UK. God. You were supposed to support
people,
me
people
on
were
this.
Very, very nice to me. That's,
but he is supporting England right now, so you can be as mean as you want him to be
my
because
t-shirt.
You're wearing Michael Winner, 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 Michael Winner,
which was made by one of our Shockers on the Shockers.
And
group.
I've got a blue one. I haven't worn it yet.
You have
but,
the one with just the text.
Made just the text.
You wanted just the text. I saw that because honestly,
I do like the picture.
There were 10 of these that existed almost immediately after you suggested
I know,
it. This is my favorite,
moment.
Which is Michael Winner smoking a cigar on the phone.
Yep.
And I just felt like I want to wear that.
I
as
think
a
somebody
shirt.
needs to make me the one where he's on the show talking about Death Wish 2 and the feminist is trying to take him down. He's just going, it's just a bit of fun, darling.
It's all in fun.
It's just like
fun.
To me, that's my favorite moment with the cigar.
That's pretty crazy, but that movie is not all in fun. I'm sorry, Michael. I don't agree with
it's
you, Michael Winner, but
movie.
I will wear your shirt.
It's just a movie. You know.
So I had a good time meeting people. Movies I saw really quickly because I know you spoke about a lot of these already. Upgrade, you spoke about last week.
Loved it.
So good.
Loved it.
Still
absolutely loved it. And it was pretty fun. The first day, I actually I had breakfast with Lee Winnell. I just happened to be in the same hotel with him. And just so you guys know, Lee does a lot of work here at the Blumhouse office, so we bump into him pretty regularly in the kitchen, which is kind of fun. So it was just kind of one of those weird things where we're both in London like, hey. And I said to him, I was like, I can't wait to see Upgrade. I didn't see it a few months ago because Ryan didn't invite us to a screening of that. But anyways, but I did get to see it in London. The crowd loved it. And it's so funny because you mentioned this on the show before I tweeted this, but I was talking about it with one of my colleagues at work, and he's like, you know what? That would be a perfect double bill with, like, The Guest.
Yeah.
It was like the two,
two
movies are great, and that's exactly the reference
And the way the soundtrack feels, and the way it feels like a little film that is punching above its weight and totally scoring the knockout, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I rather liked Insidious 3 a lot, but in terms of direction and doing a lot with a little, I mean, just Lee killed it.
Yeah, I think the direction of Insidious 3 is actually really strong. It's more just like that of the scripts. That one is the one I'm a little less interested in, you know? But yeah, this is a totally different thing.
Yeah, so I loved that. The standout, which has been mentioned on this show before, but I just got to see it, is Anne in the Apocalypse.
Yep.
I keep hearing
which
about
is
it,
coming out this December.
I will see it at Knoxville Film Festival.
It is terrific.
Cool.
Absolutely
I
terrific.
I love that people are giving so much respect to a musical.
And here's the thing. Again, I like musicals occasionally. But the thing about this one is, because it's a Christmas set zombie apocalypse musical, which are all things that I'm not sure how or why they would work. It is so brilliantly executed. It is so much fun. And more importantly, The songs are great.
Where's it from?
She's British. No, I think it's UK.
Oh, it's English language?
It's an English language, yeah.
Well, last time I
British.
Thought it was a Spanish
yeah.
thing.
But the director is John McPhail, who I met briefly there. He was there for the screenings, but he's from somewhere else. I want to say like he's from Scotland or something like that. But anyway, he did an incredible job. If I had any critique of it at all, is that because it gets a little dark towards the end. Mm-hmm. It's got such a fun tone. But that's what I love is like the good zombie movies do that. They get you into that moment and then they kind of hit you. They sucker punch you with the emotional aspect of it. I'd say it's maybe like one song too long. Like there's a point in the third act where they go into one more song. And you're kind of like, all right, now I'm in the emotion of the movie and I don't want to go to another song, even though all these songs are great. I heard through the grapevine that actually for the theatrical release, they cut that song out.
Oh, interesting.
And so that means the movie will be practically perfect by the time
it
comes out
to audience.
So
Train to Busan?
Yes, but with a great soundtrack incredible songs. And that's the thing. The songs are just so quirky and catchy and fun. And that's the key to a musical is mm-hmm. like if the songs work, then you'll get swept up in that. And that's the thing is like I know you love old school Hollywood stuff. It has that production value too where everyone starts dancing and there's choreography. And the singers, they're all terrific. They all have great voices. So that's the standout. By far, I also saw Chuck Steele, Night of the Trampires, which is an all claymation movie.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
It is insane. It is practically every cliche from the 80s action movies that we loved, except the guy Chuck Steele, who's got like a giant like blonde hair. He's fighting trampires, which are hobo vampires. Nice. This movie, there's the angry black detective boss. Yeah. It hits every trademark of it. It is pretty wild and kind of amazing. I fear that they claim they spent like $10 or $20 million on it.
Oh
like,
my gosh!
It is one of the most impressive looking claymation things. But if that's the case, it might be a while before we get to see it.
You don't think it'll be a Dread Central Presents?
it
might have been out of your budget.
I tried until I found out how much they spent on it. Because it's definitely quirk and fun. I think their best bet for an American release. Is if if somebody bought this and they like redid the voices with like Brad Pitt and like 10 amazing Chris mm-hmm. Pratt and all that,
and then just marketed the hell out of it,
then it would but it is so.
But to do that will be another $40 million.
Yes,
yeah. So now it's
gonna be an expensive movie. But if you could see it, it's wonderful. Chuck Steele, Night of the Trampires, and I also saw Gaspar Noé's Climax.
What?
How was it?
I really want to see that.
I'm
gonna like it though, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It is an experience. Well, here's the thing. It's how you feel about Gaspar's work, which to me is, I think it's terrific.
I haven't seen Love because
it's but that's the only one I haven't seen either. But I only can watch it once.
Yeah, mostly.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always completely split about the experience. Mm. I love the filmmaking. I love the ambition. But then there's other things that make me so uncomfortable.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so I gave this movie straight down the middle of 2.5, which got much debate because like, oh, it's a masterpiece. I was like, yes, there's some stuff in the first half. I mean, because a chunk of it is a musical.
So, I've heard it's Gaspar Noé's fame. Like, it's him doing fame.
Yes.
Dancing and singing. And yeah.
Is it as extreme as his normal films?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Really?
No,
okay.
I mean, well, the first
orgy
half...
Orgy stuff or... kind of.
Just wait.
Okay.
So basically, the first half is a dance
orgy
troupe.
Orgy stuff.
You know, well, that's all I think about.
It's these
stuff.
Tremendously long takes of some of the most elaborate and incredible dance stuff where you're like, how did, like, everyone's on drugs. That's the only logical explanation. But then there's a moment in, like, a split in the middle where you're actually kind of having fun and you're like, oh, cool, this movie's great.
Yeah.
But then there's a split in the middle where basically someone may have spiked them all with acid.
Yeah.
So the second half is fucking nightmare fuel.
Oh, cool.
Yes, with orgies and dancing and vomiting and all sorts of other things. And I was just so disoriented that by the end, I didn't know how I felt anymore. I was like, God damn, that almost was a masterpiece.
Well, he's the kind of guy that Khan loved to hate, like when he puts out a new movie. But this one came out, and everyone at Khan was like, oh my God, Gaspar Noé's just made like a masterpiece. So when I heard that, I was like, whoa, people are liking Gaspar's new film?
Yes.
So that got me excited.
Well, actually, that was funny. In the introduction, I think they said, oh, so people are liking this. So what went wrong?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm curious.
I think it's not even remotely commercially accessible, but it is the closest of his movies to maybe watching a second time. But I won't. I'm done. One and done with all his movies for me. But I'm dying to hear what you think of it.
Yeah, that's one I want to see. That and Von Trier's new film, House, that Jack built, the serial killer one.
Yeah,
I want to see that.
Your review is the one that's going to mean the most to me. So
okay.
Anyway, that's
no
Paris.
Pressure.
That's Fright Fest.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, that was a lot.
Yeah, intense.
All I can match you with is Das Nun.
Yeah,
it's not German.
We went to Slashback, which was awesome. Slashback was really cool.
I made an appearance.
Yes. You were there briefly. I was like, you seemed to disappear. And late night after Slashback, I convinced Elric to go to see The Nun.
Der Nun, because she likes Nun movies.
I would have went with you guys after.
I think it was decided upon after you
After,
left.
it was definitely
I went to walk Ryan's dogs.
That's not as good a story.
Yeah, Jen told me about it. Jen Wexler was there, and we were chatting, and then I was
A couple
of like,
people said nice things about it.
Okay, all right. Let's hear it, because this has been mixed across the board.
I was not a fan.
Oh.
There were parts I liked, I do have to say.
Okay, look, first, the director's awesome.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I do mean that, because I really like Karin's first film.
No,
And inside this movie, there is this little crazy Fulci movie.
Yes!
But it is being utterly crushed by mainstream filmmaking, mainstream like story.
Exactly.
Like the script, and I don't want to bag, because it's not always the screenplay, right? The screenplay might have been changed by 100 people. There's moments where the screenplay is like, I'm not kidding. I covered my face at one line.
He face palmed it.
I actually went like this with one line, because it was just so cheap. It was like more like a Jason Statham line in a big action movie than in a Fulci inspired Nun thing.
And that is kind of how a lot of it feels. It feels like if they had made this movie with five actors in this convent and that was it, it would be fucking brilliant.
And
it
the
would
ingenuity
be the witch
of the director.
Year.
Like, because there's sequences where they do quick flashbacks of creepy sequences, and it's really effective imagery. There's some imagery that would stand up against all those kind of great classical, like Dark Waters and all these kind of movies.
Yeah.
There's a really good kind of slow burn jump scare early on in a cemetery.
Yeah,
with
the
one
graveyard
of the characters.
Sequence.
And
was great.
There's some actual scary stuff, but the cliche machine starts kicking. And the one thing we kept talking about afterwards is like The Nun. You know, Vladek is like in it from start to end.
Yeah,
there's
like
no
you
mystery
see her
treated to this character
in the first 10 minutes, and she's pretty much showing up in broad daylight by like within
or just like just always around.
She's always
like,
there,
and you're like, come on, let's hold something back.
Yeah,
and be
and
scary
so,
about this.
And I wanted there, and I'm going to go ahead and say this because like there is really no backstory to it. Like, if you're going to have a haunted nun ghost in a movie, you got to give it something. Like, Elric and I were talking, like, you know, somebody has to screw somebody on an altar.
Having sex with a nun on an altar.
And, you know, we've got to have this, like, crazy story of how this cursed nun is haunting the abbey. And it's just a demon who took on a nun form because she wanted to blend in.
It might not even be a she, but there's still imagery throughout. Towards the end, there's just stuff. It's not really a spoilery movie. It's very predictable. It feels more like an episode of Exorcist, the show, like Elongate. It's kind of got much more of an Exorcist vibe. But not in a way that I think was necessarily that effective. But the setting's really cool.
Setting's
I really like
cool.
the idea of this like place where basically nuns have to be there 24/7 forever to be praying away the evil because they know
this
thing
is
there.
Bay.
That's the opening kind of idea.
Does it have? You said Fulci, but I keep hearing it has like a Hammer vibe to it in terms of atmosphere.
I'd
or is that
say
not
that's
accurate?
Only the setting. Like I didn't pick up on Hammer in any capacity.
It's more like in a negative way. It's got more Woman in Black.
Mm.
It's more trying to be that kind of a big movie. Mm-hmm. It's not as good as Woman in the Black. It's trying to be that big, but then within it, like, I mean, I really mean it. There's like I read some of our shockers. A couple people said I started watching and walked out. It's like, I get that, but I also think there was enough in this. There was enough interesting moments that I walked out going, oh, I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah.
The shame is, and it obviously made a ton of money, but it's making that based on the impression it made in Conjuring
marketing.
2 and marketing, but mostly,
yeah.
I mean, it's one I think that would be top 10 horror scenes of like the last 30 years, the scene with the painting.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a very memorable scene and sequence on its own. And so there's just, I guess it's that classic Jaws problem. Like, you just don't show the shark from, you don't get to know the shark. You don't hang out with the shark. You don't have the shark hanging around all the time.
And don't think that because it is a studio picture that you have to spend $30 million to have the floors and the building burned down and all of this
the bigger,
crazy stuff happening.
Things become, I feel like scripts get beaten into like a more generic
the
mode.
The backstory thing sounds disappointing. Because like,
it was,
know,
that
with,
is very
that
disappointing.
Was.
I was expecting like, you know, the Netflix thing, the Keepers, like fucked up kind of, like,
oh,
that's
God,
what
no.
I wanted
no.
the
needs,
nun
dude.
To be.
It's what
it needed.
It needed
to be a edge to it.
And
like,
it was
no
just
edge.
A demon who is haunting a convent, so it decides to take the form of a nun so that it blends in. And that was it. And
Tessa
I was like,
Farmiga's good in it. She's fun as the lead. And I mean, it's handsomely made. It's a good looking movie. It's just like, it's always a shame when you see those two things battling within each other. So it'd be interesting to know more, a little more behind the scenes.
The small horror sequences were the best. The giant ones with crazy digital effects where the floors are dropping away or things are exploding or something's crawling on the ceiling. That's when it lost it for me. But like the one in the graveyard was great. There are some where she's just literally walking down a hallway and you're seeing stuff behind her. Those were great moments.
Yeah. I don't think it hurts like Corin as a director at all. It's like, okay,
cool. Money. That's all.
He's showing a lot of flair in it. It's just, I think it's the story for me. It doesn't, you know.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. But,
The Nun.
But holy fucking shit, guys. Mandy.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Holy crap.
I tweeted one thing and it's been shared like a million times. Like,
oh, has just, it? Wow.
Yeah, I was surprised. I didn't even put thought into it. I just said it's
hilarious.
Like a black, like one of those. I kept thinking, oh, those black paintings. What are they called?
Black velvet paintings.
I was like, this is like a black velvet heavy metal painting that somebody then set on, came to life and then someone set it on fire. And that's literally how the movie feels. But, you know, this is one I was looking forward to for a long time, but also, you know, you worry that, is it going to just be cheesy or something, you know, just before you say it. There are a lot of anticipation, and we knew Nick Cage was going to be there. Nick Cage, who Josh Miller just texted me, have you guys already talked about Mandy on the show yet? I'm like, oh, we're about to. And he go, don't forget the quote. And I was like, all right, Nick Cage on stage saying, I am the California Klaus Kinski is definitely one of the greatest
it's
things
true.
That's ever happened.
It's
pretty good.
Which happened last night.
Well, but I really liked him saying that he became an actor mainly because he saw
James Dean
at the New Beverly.
Yeah, at the New Beverly, yeah. And he was like, is that still open?
Yeah. We don't know, Nick. We don't know.
But, you know, this just...
And we sat in front of Bill Duke.
That's
you
right.
Got, you got, anytime. Anytime. Yeah. You got really excited when I pointed out the name there.
Yeah. Eric took a picture of his chair.
Yeah, I love Bill
and
Duke.
And Nick Cage showed up in a gold lamé jacket that was just gorgeous. And he had so many... He had more security than I think the president does.
He did have a lot of security.
Like a SWAT team came in and cleared the area
as
before he came in.
As if anyone could take him on.
I don't know. I mean, somebody's looking to assassinate Cage. You can't do it, man. He's Cage.
Not if he's packing that lucky crack pipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nick.
Wow.
Anyway.
Kane.
Bad Lieutenant 2.
Kane.
Just FYI. Lieutenant 2.
I'm trying to think of my descriptions because I had a bunch on the way home. I was like, oh, it's basically, Nicolas Cage's. I was like, I love Nicolas Cage's The Punisher on Acid.
Yeah.
For starters. Where he meets the Road Warrior Cenobites.
Yeah, the Cenobite moments are really clear initially. Right?
Yeah.
But it's just, it's like, it's again, I think the closest thing I can compare Panos' two films, having only seen the two, is to S. Craig Zahler in the way that, like, they're long, they're exactly what he wants them to be, and because of that, they're singular. They're not like anything else.
Yeah.
Like, you can pastiche and copy all these things of your influences and yet still make something completely new out of it. And that's what I loved about it.
And the more I was thinking about it, well, I loved while I was watching it. It has a lot of heavy metal, obviously, overtones.
Just about to
it.
Talk about the music.
Yeah, the music is amazing. But in that same regard, I really loved that he's nuancing something that is so precise that no one else has ever nuanced, I don't think, in cinema, except for maybe the movie Heavy Metal. Which is the sci-fi fantasy kind of sword and sandal novel series.
Yeah.
They were big in the 80s. They're still going today. But he uses those as kind of framing devices throughout the movie.
And everything, yeah.
The fonts, even the plot and the way that it's shaped and how she's very kind of elfin-like. Like he's really referencing those heavy. And I'd never seen those kind of even mentioned before. It was just one
Hopefully
of those
things.
Hopefully
we can get clarity on that later.
Yeah, and I also, so I will be asking if he joins us today.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was thinking about as I went home was this cult leader clearly is existing in kind of, and I'm going to ask him about this. There was an actual cult in LA in the early 70s called the Source Family that feels very much like the...
Oh, that's a documentary, a really good documentary called Source Family. Yeah.
So Father Yod, the guy who was running it, was this big guy into LSD and acid rock and things like that. And it felt like who Nick Roche's character was almost kind of, winking at.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that it, in a way, it kind of became 80s, birth of metal and the extremity of metal and kind of the emergence into kind of this satanic culture versus what was perceived as the peace and purity of kind of this cult life and the white robes and everything, and then the two kind of converging. So once I got home and started thinking, like, this is the shit that keeps me up at night. So this was my mind at 2 a.m. last night, was breaking down the symbolism of 60s acid rock and what was happening to it when it came up against kind of the more glam metal of the early 80s.
I was just along for the ride, man. And I looked up the soundtrack as soon as I got home to buy, because it's the composer was Johan Johansson, who unfortunately is no longer with us.
Yeah, died too young.
Yeah.
And just basically with Arrival, I think, really stamped himself as like, oh, he's going to be a major force.
Oh, yeah. But it's the cover of the vinyl is fantastic, because it made sense to me when I saw it initially, photos of it before the movie. It's like that like unreadable death metal font sort of thing. With the letters. And so basically this movie is broken up like a novel, where you get these elaborate like title sequences almost when you're in another act. And that's my favorite act, is when it says Mandy. And because it is the exact logo from the front of the record. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so now you're like, oh, that's badass.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting movie. And I think what Beck is getting at by breaking down, wanting to dive into it more, is because it's on the surface so simple.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
you,
God,
you've got,
yeah.
And slow. Like, it takes its time. No, the first act, very little happens. But it's done so stylistically that you then are like drawn into all the little nuances, all the references. There's definitely a little bit of Last House on the Lefty vibe to the first act, I felt, as well as all the other movies we'll be talking about. But it's just something about it, and it's also fun. Like, I always talk about Nick Cage, you know, being my favorite screen actor of the last couple decades. But it's because when he's used right, he's like one of those tools that if you use it right, and if you understand that as a director, you're modulating in the edit a performance, you're going to get a great performance every single time. That times he's bad is, I think, because he's still giving everything, but the person receiving it doesn't know what to do with it. So anytime he works with a good director, he delivers fascinating, authentic work. And in this, he's going all the way, and it never feels over the top in that silly way where he gets mocked for. Not once did I feel like it went to that silly.
See, I think thing, others are going to perceive it differently.
They
I
might,
think that the bathroom scene, it's definitely going to end up in some memes.
Oh, yeah. But you can meme it, but it's also genius.
That's probably my favorite. There's it's a my, long,
that's my favorite.
Long
oh, yeah. It was amazing.
Scene, which we'll talk about later. But there's some of the best Cage moments ever.
Yeah,
in
no,
this
I mean
movie.
It's up there with some of his best work. And also you can afterwards he was talking about how he worked through a lot of pain, and you can tell.
You can see that
it's not just another role. It's like something's going on here.
And as of today, by the way, this is in theaters.
Yeah, no, I think
I don't know if it's
out.
VOD as well simultaneously, but it's in theaters, and I strongly recommend seeing it on the big screen.
It would not play anywhere near as well. At home.
It's so loud.
Yeah,
the music, the sound design. And just the visuals of it. You're right. It's like a painting come alive. But like, there was like one shot super early on where basically it's Cage and his girl and Mandy in the middle of an ocean. Like, it's really early on, just setting up their different moments of their intimate relationship. And it's like the most gorgeous waves kind of as it pulls back, and they're just in the middle of the ocean.
Mine was the shot where you were looking, and I won't give away too much with this, but you're looking at one character. And it's like you blink and you're suddenly like, his face looks different. And then you realize that they have superimposed another character's face over top of it perfectly, enough so that his features are just gradually changing into hers.
Yeah,
and then it goes back really quickly, and you're like, I didn't even see it change. It was so flawless.
Creepy.
Yeah. And it's nice because this one is still got the beautiful style, but he's gone away from the precision that Beyond the Black Rainbow is known for, with that Kubrickian 2001 vibe, which I'm glad he did, because even though that works for that film, for this film, I love that it's a little rougher.
Yeah.
And a little, it's not never ugly, because it's, you know, shot so beautifully, and it looks like a Super 16 or something.
It's
very grainy.
It's also more narrative.
And emotional. Quite an emotional story.
Like, Beyond the Black Rainbow, I enjoyed it when I watched it, but it was nothing that I would ever watch again, because it didn't have enough plot to kind of make me forget where I was. I was still kind of in the back of my brain going, I need to do laundry. This is cool.
Oh,
this
no,
is
I'll
weird.
Watch
I got to do laundry.
But it's also a screen. A big screen film too.
This one captured me. Yeah. So.
That one doesn't have the emotional through line. It's more like a style piece. Mm-hmm. It's like early Cronenberg versus similar trajectory. And I'm very interested to ask him if Cronenberg is an influence, just being another Canadian director, because Kubrick's an obvious visual one, but Cronenberg, you know, you think about Beyond the Black Rainbow, it's very much that world, right, of medical science and gone wrong, future imperfect stuff. So yeah, I'll be curious. But hopefully we will talk more about this excellent movie
momentarily.
We hope. Is that ever catches everyone up?
Or well, do you have I can announce. Plus I'll be in out for a couple of weeks. So I'm going to be out for 3 weeks in October because I'm directing another movie. Woohoo! This one is going to be produced by Buzz Wall. Have we ever had Buzz on the show?
Yeah, he was on for the Tension Experience episode.
Yeah, so Buzz is producing it. It's a thriller. So I've been watching a whole bunch of thrillers. So for the next couple of weeks leading up to when I'm going to disappear for 3 weeks of production, I'm going to be talking about thrillers. And this week I'm going to talk about Mute Witness, which if you have not seen before, I won't talk much about it because I think I probably mentioned it on Killer POV at some point.
It's come up periodically throughout. It's definitely one of my it's got the front cover you'd recognize because it's got the word mute is like
sewn
into the girl's mouth and underneath is witness.
Yeah.
But terrific, terrific thriller.
Yeah.
Great movie.
So I've been doing a thriller a night, just kind of getting myself in the atmosphere of building the tension and things like that. And this one, it just always sticks with me. Every single time I watch it, the setup is so clever. It's about a girl who is deaf. She can hear, but she can't speak. And she is working as a costumer on a film set. And she maybe she can't hear. Now I'm trying to remember.
No, she's mute.
She's mute.
She can hear,
and
so she sound languages. She can't speak, though, yeah.
That's it. And yeah, so she's working on a film set. She's a costumer and does props and stuff. And she sees a murder. And she tries to tell people about it, but ultimately it becomes that she's kind of being stalked by the killer.
Well, she walks in on a film set.
Yes.
And thinks she's watching a horror movie or a porno movie.
But it's real.
And then it turns into a snuff film. So we think. Yeah. We don't know.
I wasn't going to divulge that part, Rob.
The snuff film is very important to it.
Oh, I know, but that's like one of the, that's like act one break. That's like plot point.
I didn't spoil it nearly as much as you spoil things on the regular. I'm sorry.
I think this is just set up. We can get away with it. It's like body double.
I was just like, she's on a film set. She sees murder. But yeah, no. So she thinks she's watching porno and then they kill her.
How old is this movie? If it's 20 years, it doesn't count.
But not only that, but the point is, so now the not only can she not communicate what she thinks she saw, but the people, because the people are like, we're just making a horror movie. It's just a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't. She can't prove the murder.
Yep.
That's the other thing. And that's where it gets very interesting is because we believe her.
And we've seen it.
And we've seen it too.
It reminds
but
me of
she
that.
She can't prove it to anybody.
The making of Cannibal Holocaust, where the guy actually, the actual actor in Cannibal Holocaust thought that he was on the set of a snuff film. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, he's like, oh, we are here. Like, someone's going to be killed. And I always thought that was an amazing
kind
of analogy. Just, it's such a cool setup. And the tension throughout the whole thing. And much of it is built out of what Rob described, the idea that the audience knows exactly what's going on, but that she can't tell anybody else and no one believes her. And it's just so frustrating and beautiful through the whole movie. So if you guys have not seen Mute Witness, I highly recommend
what's that on now?
Out.
I saw it on VHS when it first came
DVD.
Out.
DVD. I have DVD.
I have not seen it since.
Yeah, it's not gotten a proper Blu-ray or anything. I wish somebody would get the rest.
Who made it? Wasn't it Austrian or something?
Anthony Waller.
Okay.
And the great joke is Alec Guinness has a credit in this.
Yeah.
That's right.
But that is something that Anthony Waller shot at an airport. He like tracked him down.
He's in a car. It's like so quick.
And that's why he had this piece of footage that have you heard the story?
Yeah.
You would love it.
It came from something on Killer POV. I definitely.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this one on POV.
He basically, I think he just like kind of stalked Alec Guinness when he was coming home from an airport. Like he's at the airport. And was like, can I just shoot a quick thing with you in the car? And he's like, oh, fine, just whatever. And so, because there were rights issues to use that footage because it was literally just him randomly like annoying Alec Guinness at his car when he was getting home from the airport. And he's like the man behind everything. Like he's crafted it into a plot point into this movie.
I wonder if Alec got paid. I hope so.
I doubt it.
It's crazy.
If you're going to be the main plot point of a movie,
it's literally like less than 2 minutes worth of footage.
Yeah, it's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, he just pops up out of nowhere. And I've also, I watched Single White Female a couple nights ago, which I have to say, maybe a perfect film. That film, and you need to rewatch it if you haven't seen it since the 90s. But just, I mean, amazing cast, Jennifer Jason Leigh.
I think I saw it 2 times in theaters when it came. I liked it that much. I was like, I got to see that again.
It's
peak for both of them. They're both
perfect
great.
Three acts. The character arcs. Like I could teach script writing based on that movie.
Steven Weber.
Jeff Nelson agrees with you from Scream Factory.
Yeah, no, it's a really fun movie. Who directed that one? I don't know if I even know.
I don't even know off the top of my head. So yeah, that was one.
Is
that
a lot of fun.
It's just tight. So I'll be talking about a couple more thrillers as we go.
Okay.
Very cool. Well, we're going to hear from our sponsors one more time, and then we're going to delve in with our guests.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, so hang tight.
Caveat.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Just released the Teen Wolf collection, featuring all new shirts and enamel pins, as well as the exclusive shirt and enamel pin for the documentary Haunters, The Art of the Scare. The director of that will be on next week, by the way, which is now streaming on Netflix. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that is SUMMERSHOCK10. Go to www.fright-rags.com now.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA. Coming soon from Wellgo USA, we have three amazing movies. First up is Gonjim. Based on the local legends and stories of people who visited the real-life abandoned hospital, Gonjim Haunted Asylum, follows the crew of a horror web show who plan to stream live from inside the asylum, but encounter much more than expected. On digital, Blu-ray, combo, and DVD September 18th, Wellgo USA also has Phantasm in a beautiful 4K scan, The Tall Man is Back with a Vengeance. And they also have, coming soon, Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead, Phantasm 4, Oblivion. Two cult classics and Don Coscarelli's legendary horror franchise make their standalone Blu-ray debuts September 18th. Check them out online at www.wellgousa.com. That's wellgousa.com. Boy.
Tonight's show is also sponsored by the film Don't Leave Home. In theaters and on demand today, Don't Leave Home brings to life a chilling urban legend. It's the film critics are calling Get Out with Catholic guilt in the Irish countryside and dubbing an atmosphere waking nightmare. From the teams at Shudder and Cranked Up Films, visit www.don'tleavehomefilm.com for more info. Additionally, Shudder is giving out a free 30-day trial to check out their service. Use promo code STAYHOMESW at checkout. Again, that's STAYHOMESW to get a free 30-day trial and check out Don't Leave Home.
This week's episode is also sponsored by RLJE Films. Find out what's really going on behind enemy lines in the gruesome thriller Trench 11, out now on DVD, VOD, and digital. A deadly disease created by German forces on the loose and spreading fast. Will Lieutenant Burton be able to stop the outbreak and end the war? Find out in this dark world war horror. Gruesome Magazine calls it a cinematic thrill ride. Get Trench 11 on Amazon.com now.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network has launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, Clark Wolf, through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awaits. This week, we are also launching Attack of the Queer Wolves. Join Mark Fortin and Michael Kennedy, along with Nay Bevers, as they journey into the queer side of horror films. Both are available now on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative and Attack of the Queer Wolf.
All right, so we've been doing the show for about 6 years or something like that. And,
or a variation of it.
Variation. And right at the very start, I had seen Beyond the Black Rainbow and got really excited. And was like, let's get Panos Cosmatos in. And then found out he lived in Canada.
And you found out that I had died.
Well, resurrected.
And then we found out that site was lying to us. Yeah. Very wrong. Yeah, it was like, the Facebook rumor. And
so this is one of the first follow-up movies we've ever had from a deceased director, which is super exciting. Zombie directed. But yeah, welcome, Panos.
Thanks. Hey, it's great to be here.
And congrats on an utterly badass LA premiere, I guess it was, last night.
Is that the first screening?
Yeah, that was the first screening here in LA.
This is the first podcast I've ever done. So.
Are you serious?
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
I apologize in advance for being super terrible.
No,
we're honored that we're your first.
We'll be interviewed by someone before, and I knew you were one of us because I hear once you start talking about movies, that's what we do here. So yeah. We want to talk about like movies you love and horror films. So there's no gotcha questions. You don't have to worry.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, I might have been on another podcast that I didn't know was one where somebody
recorded
me on audio, and then it was a podcast all of a sudden.
Yeah, you just
that was different.
So this could be a controversial statement. I've never been on a podcast.
But this is the first one you're aware is a podcast.
You are sitting in the room. Yeah, in you shape. Have headphones on. It's official now.
Yeah, it's official.
So, yeah.
But now, did you actually watch it last night on the screen?
No, I don't watch it anymore. I can't watch the stuff I do with the audience. It's too gut-churning.
It's stressful. So
it's really stressful for me, to me. Yeah. I did watch it at Cannes just because it was Cannes, and I thought maybe this will be the only opportunity I have to watch this movie at Cannes.
Yeah.
So, but then I had like an out-of-body experience while I was watching it where time lost all meaning, and I was looking at myself, and it just seemed like this weird fugue state hell escape. Yeah. And then I didn't know whether it seemed like it lasted for 5 hours or 5 minutes, and then the movie was over.
The film kind of takes place in that same state, though. But like I'll say last night, that kind of audience was like the perfectly wired into what you're doing. So I think the energy was incredible. And for me, it was what I loved about it in comparison to Beyond the Black Rainbow, which I always love, is like that you kind of have shied away from the precision of that and gone for the emotion.
Yeah.
The heart of this movie is really palpable.
Yeah. It was an attempt to move, sort of do the exact flip side of Black Rainbow in a way, something that was like operatic and super emotional instead of all everything being reserved and controlled.
Yeah.
I think this is, this is episode 113 of this show. We had Spectrevision on for episode 3 way back then, and I believe they were talking
about—
They told
us off air.
It wasn't on the show. But they were talking about Manny back then. And so how long have you lived with the story, and was this always meant to be your second film, or were there other ideas that you were exploring about maybe being the next one?
Are we recording now?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
Welcome to the podcast.
I actually started writing Mandy at basically the exact same time as Black Rambo because I was dealing with all this grief that was piling up on me in my life, and I finally went to therapy and realized that I was a basket case, and being able to purge some of my emotions in therapy gave me a little bit of clarity, and I realized, I need to make a fucking movie, and enough of this sitting around in my basement in my house, thing. And so I started writing Black, and I realized that I'd been working in different art forms. I did like photography and collages and short films, and I, part of that clarity was I realized I need to take all that creative energy that I had that was being dispersed out into different things and put it all into just movies forever. And I had this weird concept art that I was working on that ended up getting incorporated into Black Rainbow and stuff like that. But Black Rainbow is it's such a controlled movie, and it's very claustrophobic. And it became like a really intense sort of ordeal writing it. And at a certain point, I think just without even knowing it consciously, I needed some kind of antidote to that. So I started writing – that's when I started writing Mandy as a sort of like primal antidote to Black Rainbow.
Was there like an origin image or memory or something in your life that was going on that where Mandy came from, that initial spark for that particular
– Well, it started – the very first thing was, and this has happened to me before, where I will just watch like every movie in a series, and then get kind of like fascinated and fixated on that genre. So I ended up, for whatever reason, watching all of the Death Wish films.
We were just talking about Death Wish too.
He's wearing a Michael Winner. Two and three, I believe.
Yes.
And J. Lee Thompson. We're just talking.
And J. Lee Thompson.
I'm fascinated because of where when I do that all the time too, where I'll start something, I was like, well, now I got to go through the whole franchise. I'm fascinated where that series kind of went, because they kind of, because the first movie is arguably a masterpiece for what it is. I just saw the remake, which is what it is, but like the first one is just such a when it comes to like kind of the revenge style movie,
it's somewhat believable.
It's incredible that he was, the architect. He doesn't actually get the guys that were responsible. It's just an interesting look.
Just
and it's
acting out against anybody.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's my favorite final shot of a movie ever.
Again, it's emotional. Like, they still had the emotion, like kind of what you're able to contain in this movie. Whereas as it goes, it becomes a formula.
The first Death Wish is a vigilante movie where he's just like killing criminals.
Yeah.
Just because they're bad, quote unquote bad. And then it becomes a straight up sort of revenge film.
Superhero almost, yeah. Too, yeah.
He's attacking the people that wronged him specifically. Yeah. Whereas in Death Wish 1, like you said, he never even like finds or talks to the people who did the heinous act at the beginning of that one.
Yeah. And you could believe you would do it. So what was it in the death? I mean, it's all pretty obvious to me some of the connections you're finding.
But the thing is, like when you are watching all those movies in a row, you know, with no space in between them, you start to sort of ruminate and kind of about on what this genre is and how it functions and what's interesting about it and what doesn't work about it and what's kind of grotesque about it, what's beautiful about it. And so I just sort of find myself becoming very sort of enamored of the machinations of the genre and what you could do with it and how you could live within that kind of a structure and where you could go from there. And that's how I started writing Mandy, is the sort of almost like a meditation on revenge movie. But I realized from watching the Death Wish films that I wanted to make a revenge movie that kind of focused or orbited around the person that was being avenged. Mm-hmm. Because in these films, you know, the person who gets killed or whatever tends to just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
And I wanted a revenge movie that was like a love song about the person that was being avenged in a way.
Yeah, wow. Usually they're just the catalyst to the plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Mandy haunts this movie throughout, and even with animation and other ways that just kind of, get under your skin, mm-hmm. in terms of how somebody might romanticize that person.
Her absence and how he thinks of her and her the way she lives in his mind is like what drives him forward throughout the film.
And the reason he can keep physically moving, because he shouldn't be able to move anymore probably, right? The other thing we had heard compared, and obviously it's the same experience, I think, which we've all had, which is watching all the Friday 13th movies in a row, which is a similar thing. You mm-hmm. end up watching them going, why do we love these? Like, why do we keep coming back? There's a ritualistic element that's very hard to decode, but it's there.
Yeah.
And I think Death Wish has similar, but I've heard Nick Cage say that at one point he was playing Jason.
Yeah, he told.
I don't know if that's just an analogy, but
he said like the second half of this movie, he decided I'm going to be like Jason for Friday 13th, which I was like, all right.
No, cool. when we first got together and started talking about how the characters should sort of progress through the film, we broke it down into three sections where he starts as a sort of a normal man, albeit one who's a bit kind of maybe damaged and haunted mm-hmm. by his past. But has found this, safety and warmth with Mandy. And then after she's gone, that's stripped away and he sort of reverts to where he was before, and he's this like angry, animalistic, raw nerve of a creature. But then after he takes the drugs in the later part of the film, then at that point he becomes almost like a demigod that's enacting her will on the earthly plane. And I thought Jason might be a good
because he's like, he's doing it for his mother in a sense.
Yeah.
Is it his mother?
But just for the body language, to sort of give like a new dimension to the character physically during that last part of the film. So I gave Nick Friday the 13th Part 7 to watch.
I love that so much.
I want to get some audio commentary of him watching that movie.
That is my favorite one, guys. That's where you get the telepathic.
Yeah, no, the telekinetic stuff's really fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that makes it so great. So special Part 7 is that it's like a mashup of different genres.
Yeah. I thought that one of the things that you did really well to keep the idea of Mandy and kind of her haunting the film was she is the texture. She is like everything. And even kind of the way that the whole film is set up, she's the heavy metal. Mm-hmm. She is the kind of fantasy novels. She is, basically like all of the things that kind of are preserved throughout as the texture of the movie are set up by Mandy. And so then they're endured, even the t-shirt.
I feel like the movie can be looked at literally, but I also wanted you to be able to watch the film, and from a certain point on in the film, it can also be kind of read as just being her daydream from a certain point on. It's sort of her rumination, her daydream during.
It feels like kind of fatalistic too. Like there's a really nice scene early on, and this isn't really spoiler, where this family, the cult kind of family, are driving by and they see her, and the way they look at each other, there's just this feeling that she was someone fated to be doomed in a sense, and it's something really sad and haunting about her, the actress, and just the way, and also that makes the fact that they got to experience love, her and Nick, for any period of time is kind of, it just raises the stakes, I think, emotionally. Yeah. So it's, I wouldn't have expected that from your film, having seen Beyond, to that kind of romanticism and that keeps it going. But I want to make sure we go back, because I'm really curious about movies you watched young and We're a big movie nerd, so I want to make before we get to Man, all the way to Mandy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because yeah, I told you guys, I want to dig in on my theories of Mandy. So, yeah, yeah.
Well, but I mean, we're
going to go back.
The thing we always ask every because look, the reason we're in this room is because at some point we were too young to see something that affected us so deeply, and that we had to keep going back to it to either conquer that fear or to just whatever. So, what was it for you? What was the earliest horror recollections you have? What was the first thing that really scared you?
The very first thing that really scared me was. The first films I ever saw were Super 8 highlight reels because we lived in rural Sweden. But my dad would go to London and come back with like toys and Super 8 highlight reels. So most of my entertainment were like highlight reels of like Super Fuzz and like one of the Herbie films. I remember the Three Caballeros, the very surreal musical number.
I have such love for Super Fuzz, and I don't know why. Have you rewatched it recently?
It's been a few years, but
it does not hold up as well as you think it
would. Well, I don't know. I'll probably find it incredibly soothing. But I remember the first thing that scared me on one of those was it was 1 million years BC with Raquel Welsh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a giant turtle that comes out of the ocean that's just a normal turtle, but it's supposed to be giant.
Yeah.
And something about that just like on some primal level like freaked me out so badly that I couldn't even look at it.
How old do you think you were around then?
Four.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe three. But then we ended up moving to London, and my mother took me to this weird children's repertory cinema that was underneath the ground. And they were doing a double feature of Pinocchio and 20,000 Leagues Beneath the Sea.
Oh, God, there's so much nightmare trauma in both of those. The island of – the island
Misfit,
where they give the boys
Misfit
all
– Toys?
Is it Misfit Toys?
I don't know.
It's the island where in Pinocchio they give the kids like beer and
the Misfit Toys is the Christmas one with Rudolph.
Pleasure Island. It is Pleasure Island in it. It has a technical term.
Literally, the only thing I remember about Pinocchio is when he gets swallowed by the whale.
Yeah, yeah.
And that like really made it.
Once you're inside it's totally frightening. Yeah, yeah.
Him on the raft. I don't know. Like I kind of fixated on rafts, like lashing pieces of wood together and making a raft, like just the way those words sound. Because, one of the other Super 8 reels we had was Swiss Family Robinson.
I love that movie so much.
Wow, you're hitting on the sweet spot.
Oh, my God. Swiss Family Robinson. It's amazing.
But so you're not even watching these whole movies. You're seeing, like, these pieces of a movie, the highlights of it, which is interesting, too. Because
that's
creating a montage.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. Well, it's before home video, so
yeah.
Interesting. So, what was like? Do you remember the first like straight horror film, like the 2 hour film that you actually saw?
No,
so not Kinder Trauma so much.
It went in level. But then in just to be more like in 20,000 Leagues underneath the Sea, the squid that Kirk Douglas fights at the end, and then it opens up tentacles and it has this horrible beak that he stabs, and that upset me. But then the first pure horror image that I remember was when we were now living in L.A. and my parents were watching TV in their bedroom, and I was supposed to be asleep, and I peered around the corner, and they were watching Squirm.
Oh, yeah. Jeff Lieberman has been a guest.
We've had him on the show.
Yeah, I love his films. But at the time, I didn't know who Jeff Lieberman was.
Yeah.
But I looked around the corner right in time for when the guy comes up out of the lake, and he's got all the worms eating into his face, and that traumatized me for sure.
Oh, yeah. Because that could actually happen.
That or the egg cream.
All you need is a little electricity hitting the worms, and that shit could go down in Georgia.
I remember when we had him on, he said that his hell was going to be like the ghost of like 5,000 worms eating him alive over and over.
Yeah, I believe it. Actually, your Beyond the Black Rainbow feels like what you would experience on Blue Sunshine. Like if you took the drug Blue Sunshine, you would have Beyond the Black Rainbow. Yeah. I think those films connect in the universe.
There's a bit. Yeah, well, there's definitely some Blue Sunshine and Black Rainbow.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. But he didn't really get to do trippy visuals, so I think he lost out on that one. Was there a certain point where you started like loving this feeling and watching movies that?
Well, I always felt drawn to it. I wanted to see more. Like in that same apartment, they were watching Alien in the living room, and again, I was supposed to be asleep, and I looked around the corner and I could see Alien reflected in the painting in the print behind them, and managed to watch a bit of like Alien, and it was terrifying. But eventually, they sort of heard me or something, and I had to run back another room, and I only saw a bit of Alien.
Did you going to sets if you're a kid? Mm-hmm. Did that changed the way you saw what a movie was, or it didn't really affect when you're watching?
No, I always responded to movies in the most intense emotional way, as if it was real to me. You know, it took me many years. I was the most squeamish, afraid child viewer ever. You know, like the slightest bit of gore would make me cover my eyes. I was terrified of any kind of violence.
See, we're always, because everyone, most of the people who get into this have that same kind of reaction when they're young. And we're always curious, at what point does that shift that you start chasing that thing that really put you off? And
chasing
scared.
The dragon.
Yeah. It's like I can't really remember. I mean,
think
for me,
we still do that.
Yeah.
We're trying to
find.
Well,
that's it. I'm still always trying to get that same rush, that same high from horror.
Well, that feeling of The Shining, it's like a tractor beam pulling you
overwhelmed with fear, you know?
Yeah. That's it, exactly.
And it's getting harder and harder.
And I want to leave the movie and find myself 3 days later. Lake Mungo is the one that I use as an example, where 3 days later, I'm like, holy shit, I didn't even think about that. I got to go back and rewatch that scene. And I love that feeling. Lake Mungo? Lake Mungo.
I haven't watched that one yet.
Really good.
Australian, right?
Yeah, really good.
Found footage-y.
Yeah, it's you got to get over the found footage, because there's so much there. So, that's one that I always think about.
Sold.
Yeah.
So it's cheating, because we already heard you talk last night, but we heard you mention a double feature, 80s double feature, that totally warms my heart, because it's my favorite Scorsese movie. But what was it about seeing this double feature, and you can kind of recount it, that turned you on to, I have to make movies?
Right. Because
that's powerful.
I always liked movies, and you know, I had some knowledge about them, obviously, from being around my dad and from watching a lot of them and talking to him about them and reading about them. But it didn't click for me that I knew that I wanted to be a director until I watched Evil Dead 2 and After Hours, basically back-to-back.
Yeah.
And they both have extremely kind of overt camera mechanics in them that really draw attention to the sort of mechanics of making a film.
Yeah.
And something about that just illustrated it for me in a way that my feeble mind could understand.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. You're actually meant to notice movie making, like Michael Ballhaus, the cinematography, and Evil Dead, obviously.
And I just thought there was there was something beautiful about it, about how, especially in this case of After Hours, how Scorsese was making you aware of the mechanics, of the filmmaker as part of this sort of almost like a character in the film. And it just made it click for me that the director could be like an artist who could use this tool.
What age
to
was that?
Themselves. Whatever year it was that Evil Dead 2 came out.
Oh, okay.
87 or so?
87.
Maybe,
okay.
Yeah. I've said it before. Evil Dead 2 is the first movie that I I saw behind the curtain. I understood. I was like, oh, maybe they played that backwards, and that's how smoke is going in, or I could see it, and I'm like, oh, now I understand how that was made.
Yeah,
and it still worked. It still was like, oh, but that's cool.
Yeah,
you know, what a great idea.
There's something very almost there's something pleasing about seeing the seams a bit, you know.
Well, I think especially filmmakers like movies that are movies. It's not just escapism, and it's not just invisible editing. You actually want to notice craft.
Yeah, like I've mentioned before, that Suspiria was mine, where it was the first movie I recall watching where I go, I don't know where that weird light's coming from. They must just have put it there. Why would they just put it there if it's not something? And then suddenly I wanted to see behind it. I wanted to know what was going on.
Right.
I wanted to see the artifice of it. So,
Well, you had mentioned that you had dabbled in different type of creative outlets, but painting and photography, things like that. But after seeing that double bill, was it a long stretch before tackling filmmaking yourself? Or how did that start?
Yeah. I saw the double bill, and then just continued living my life not making movies. You know, I made short films every couple of years, but I had this really intense self consciousness about it because my dad made films, and after Rambo 2 came out, it was almost like a social like a pop culture phenomenon.
It was actually the first line in my life as a kid. I think I was 9 that I ever imitated at school. And I thought I was so smart when I'd go up to people and go, I'm going to get you. It was my favorite line in movies. Because in New Zealand, where I grew up, we only had one TV station at that time. So when Rambo 2 played on TV, you saw that before you saw Rambo, First Blood. So,
but it made me, because we lived not in LA, and maybe if we'd lived here, it would have been different, you know, because I was just one other random fucking stupid kid, but on Vancouver Island, it felt outlandish and weird, and it made me feel I was, very self-conscious about what my dad did. And
did you guys choose to live in Vancouver, or was that work? Okay,
yeah,
to live away.
Yeah, I think my mom wanted to live someplace or raise me someplace that was kind of like more like Sweden. Yeah. I tried Mexico first. Oh, and I wasn't very Sweden-like.
Who'd have thought?
Can't imagine. But at the same time, you're getting this great internationality of this. Were you seeing horror films in each one of these?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really
my,
cool.
My dad, actually, I realized in retrospect, like when I think back on the years, my dad really loved horror movies. He'd always go out to go see them. Like when we lived in Guadalajara, I remember he went with a friend to go see Motel Hell.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
And he came back and was like, there was rats crawling in the aisles of the theater. It was scarier than the movie. And I was like, awesome. And he told me that he went and saw The Thing. Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
And that he sat next to a person of diminutive stature.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Who was screaming in terror entire time, and it was just like that was like
that would, that's good. Well, I always say, I mean, we've talked about Cobra on here quite a bit, and
yeah.
The Cobra, obviously part of Cobra is a horror film, so you know the cult that's stuff in Cobra.
Well, that's actually the genre that interested me in making Mandy is like it's a sort of a rare hybrid, the action horror film.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Silent Rage.
Oh yeah,
the Chuck Norris.
I think that's the opening scene of that is amazing.
Yeah.
In the house with the guy with the axe. It's actually quite scary.
Yeah, I really love Silent Rage.
Well, I love everything except his cop partner. Those scenes get really goofy, but everything else I love.
That's one of my favorite things about the film. Yeah. You know, over the years is that insane relationship that he has with his partner.
Yeah, it's
so weird.
Yeah. But that is, yeah, tonal inconsistencies are always interesting in those movies. That's the interesting thing. Mandy, you don't really have
like
that,
a,
though.
A large, like a big-boned simpleton.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like almost like a man-child who, like, Chuck Norris is taken care of in a way. It's very weird.
Maybe there's all another storyline. A much deeper one we aren't aware of.
They just give him the job to make him feel like he's needed.
Yeah. So what about, because I guess I'm always interested, if you're moving around, were you like a VHS kid? Were you like involved in the VHS store and just kind of how you've discovered movies?
Well, my dad ended up actually he chose Beta, the losing format. And
it was slightly better quality.
And I think from that point on, I've sort of absorbed this curse of choosing the losing format too.
I chose
HD DVD.
So all of your life decisions go back to Betamax, right?
That's
there.
Funny. It was preordained. You never had a chance, you know.
Well, actually, it's funny because you mentioned yesterday at the Q&A. Speaking of that, was that you wanted to just go home and play like Intellivision or whatever?
Right.
Yep.
I had Intellivision.
Yeah.
I wanted Atari.
The losing
I got
format.
Intellivision.
We had Texas Instruments. Did anybody else have that? You had to plug it into your television. But it wasn't like it wasn't good games.
But it was
like,
a computer.
It was a computer, but it was still computer games. Like we had Atari too, but my parents always pushed me towards the Texas Instruments.
I had a friend who had Texas Instruments, and I remember coveting the Texas Instruments computer in the toy department in the basement of the local department store.
Yeah, it was technically a computer, but you couldn't do anything cool with it.
Technically a computer.
Technically
I think that was
a
her
computer.
Ad campaign. That's right.
Yeah. Made by Ridley Scott. Technically a computer. I was very curious because in my mind you were just Canadian and had always grown up in Canada, but clearly not. So I was curious about the Cronenberg, like if there was a Cronenbergian influence. Yeah. Oh, you are?
I'm 54 years old, so.
Yeah. But like with Beyond Black Rainbow, the Kubrick influence, you know, obviously visually seemed very clear. But like I was just curious about Cronenberg because obviously the Institute seemed very Cronenbergian. But just him as a general influence, I was curious if that was a big impact on you or not really.
Not from like a filmmaking mechanics point of view, but
because the films are pretty cold, I don't think that about Mandy now at all.
But I did always. But my thing that I love the most about him is he's I think he's one of the most transgressive filmmakers that ever lived. You know that he was almost like the William S. Burroughs of filmmaking or something, and that he just really feels like he was tearing your mind
never
open,
shies away
you
from
know?
It. Yeah,
and you know. Peeling back layers that you've never thought of, you know, you'd ever see.
Literally.
Yeah, literally, quite literally.
Were there other directors, though, whose bodies of work that you just really devoured?
But on a purely, like, fetishistic aesthetic level, I really liked the early Cronenberg stuff. Hmm. And it's kind of hard. I mean, I thought maybe for a while it was by accident because he was just shooting low-budget films in, like, Ontario and Quebec, that the locations he chose might have just been of that ilk. Mm. Almost by accident, in a sense. But when you go back and look at his early short films that he filmed at the University of Ontario, wherever the hell that was, and he's very, very consciously choosing these very austere, it's like a very specific kind of feeling of like wood paneled ceilings, but also you know, weird modern furniture and concrete, like brutalist architecture, you know, and that aesthetic is really appealing to me. There's Vancouver's full of architecture by this guy called, God damn it, I'm going to draw a blank on his name now, of course, that I'm on a podcast.
Don't worry.
Arthur Erickson.
No one who is listening is going to be a Vancouver architecture expert. So
people can Google
clear.
It.
They can Google.
His name's Arthur Erickson. And,
there we go. Oh, yeah. Got it back.
Yeah, and he just makes these incredible – or made these incredibly beautiful sort of brutalist concrete buildings. And that was sort of one of the driving factors of the aesthetic of Black Rainbow.
Yeah.
Wow. Kind of – coincides a bit with the, I think, the Cronenberg stuff that I liked.
Because it's less clear to me, Mandy. Like, I see all sorts of influences, and that's what's interesting about it. But I always think that the real challenge of a great piece of art is, like, there are these influences, but it becomes something totally unique. Yeah. The one that I kept thinking about throughout the film was, and I have no idea if this is actually an influence, but it was God Told Me To, is the main movie. I kept thinking about Richard Lynch every time your villain's on screen, because the way he kind of glows. And I remember watching that movie. I mean, I've never had a bigger twist in a movie in my life than watching God Told Me To, where it kind of turns
That's
into
a
this.
Deeply upsetting movie.
Yeah. It's so strange.
Oh, it's very oily.
Yeah.
Yes. That describes it perfectly.
But that's what I was feeling every time the cult, you know, was on screen. But that's the fun thing about it.
I don't generally think about actors when I'm writing, but I did think a bit about Richard Lynch when I was writing.
And I feel validated, because I definitely – he kind of radiated. And he's fantastic in your film too. Yeah. You know, that's – yeah.
So I have to ask, because I mentioned it at the beginning on your source material. So at its core, what the movie almost boiled down to me was acid rock and kind of the lifestyle of the 60s mixed with the emerging metal culture of the 1980s was what it really did boil down to me. And in that, how much did you pull from the Source family or Father Yod?
Well, I've never seen those, but over the years I had read a lot about cults and stuff like that, and I became kind of fixated on the idea of various cults. So I just kind of drew, you know, at random from that, whatever felt right, whatever felt like it would work for this particular cult, you know?
Yeah, it was very timely. Like, it actually felt realistic in the way that everything was set up and the behavior of the people. So, that was really – I liked it.
I wanted to backtrack for a second, if I may. One more thing about Cronenberg that occurs to me is that I was kind of like, too, the way he treated the gore effect in an almost, like, sculptural way where he would, if something was a gore effect shot, instead of, like, showing it really quickly to try to make it feel real – he would linger on a shot like that for like moments and moments at a time until he became hyper aware that it was like a makeup effect, which made these moments feel almost sculptural, you know. And he kept on doing this throughout his whole career, you know. In a Videodrome, there's a part where a guy's getting shot on the ground and then he starts to mutate and just stays on it for an extraordinarily long amount of time. Yeah. And even all the way up into I think it was A History of Violence.
Oh, yeah.
There's a throat slit. Maybe it was the other one.
Eastern Promises. I think it is. Where they're shaving the guy and they cut his throat.
And he like lingers on this throat slashing gag for like way too long for it to be reasonable, you know? And it goes beyond being gross, just being utterly bizarre.
Well, I think part of that is because he genuinely is obsessed and finds these things beautiful. I think he's the kind of guy who'll look through a laboratory scope and at a virus and probably would find that beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's rare. He doesn't want to look away, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Dead Ringers, as a kid, that was the one that fucked me up most of any movie, probably just because I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand gynecology at the age of 7 or whatever it was on TV. And, you know, just, but he doesn't shy away from it. He keeps showing you more and more. And I think it's because he wants to see it. He's not even thinking about us. He wants to look at it. And I think that's really unique.
It made me wonder too, does he think of this almost like sculpture, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
I would
true.
Definitely think so. Because even when you're looking into something like Existenz, where he has, like, by this time, he's got a good budget, everything in that is so well sculpted to look very, and I mean, even Videodrome to a degree, but I would say definitely a Naked Lunch, where everything becomes kind of a piece of art in itself.
Yeah.
Like even the gore itself is a character. Sometimes it is a literal character, but even when it's just something like a appendage getting cut off, like that itself is a character.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I wanted to talk about your working relationship with actors, because in this film, I mean Cage, we reviewed it before you came on, and I think some of the best Cage moments of all time are in this movie. In particular, the bathroom scene is one of one of the highlights for sure.
Well, and just a bit about Cage, because I'm curious now that you've directed him, and hopefully won't get in the way of your quest, is he just feels like he gives 100% to everyone he works with, but that not everyone knows how to use that 100% in the edit or in the direction.
That's a great way to...
You know what I mean? It's like, I don't think he's the kind of guy who's just doing cheapo knockoff movies for the sake of it. I think some of the time he's still giving everything.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
He just strikes me as an incredibly dedicated actor.
Yeah.
Who really loves what he does and does not half-ass it. You know?
Yeah. That's what
How
I love about him.
Did you shoot the bathroom scene? Because watching it, it felt kind of like the beginning of Apocalypse Now, where, you know, it was just like, let's just put Martin Sheen drunk in a bedroom and let the camera roll and see what happens. Is that...
My thought with that scene was I kind of wanted it to almost feel like a one-act play theater of the absurd. You know, where suddenly we're sort of detached from reality and we're looking at like a synthetic set with this man's life just kind of in ruins. And, you know, he's... feels disconnected from his reality, so nothing even looks or feels real, you know, and it's just looking at it almost like through a microscope, or like you're suddenly watching this weird off-Broadway one-act play about a guy.
Yeah, right. But it shows everything he can do.
Every emotion.
Yeah. Right. Well, it goes from the thing that people laugh at him about, like online, he goes to the place which seems really big, and then 2 seconds later, it breaks your heart, and you almost want to cry for him. Any actor who can do that is an instrument on a different level.
As soon as we had Cage, I realized that I didn't want to let that opportunity go to waste.
Yeah.
I didn't want to squander an opportunity to work with him, because I'd always just been in awe of his ability and the fact that I felt like he had this very outre kind of like perspective on what acting could be, you know, like that it was like could be like Dadaist performance art in a way, or he was aware of the film as a pop culture artifact, which is something that I'm interested in, you know.
Yeah,
like when I read about him making Vampire's Kiss,
yeah,
and his
which he considers his best, right? I've heard him say that before.
Well,
him saying his secretary's name in that movie deserves an Oscar. So yeah,
I mean that it's one of the funniest performances in history. It's incredible. It's so fucking funny. But there's a part in that film where he starts to cry, but he actually says "boo hoo," and he said that he wanted to see if he could articulate actual sadness from his character, but like using cartoon word bubbles, you know?
Wow. Well, I always think of Peggy Sue Got Married, because that's where he clearly made a choice.
Right.
And Francis Coppola let him do it. I think it's a great performance, but it's a choice. Like,
it's a choice. And apparently the studio hated it and really wanted him gone.
I think Kathleen Turner hated it too.
But again, there's a sort of organic reason for it. He wasn't just doing a weird voice. He was like, this is a teenage boy and his voice is breaking. And he doesn't sound like an idol. You know, he's just like a weird, awkward guy, you know.
Were there any particular Cage performances that like were besides the ones you're just mentioning that
I always think about a movie called Birdie that I think Alan Parker directed that has this beautiful ending. I really like abrupt endings.
Yeah, Alan Parker in general is really good, underrated director,
and that movie has a beautiful, like a poetically abrupt ending that I've always, and in it Cage is just like, it's just a very delicate, sensitive performance, you know, which he hasn't done very many of all told.
Yeah,
but you know, I always remember that performance.
And when you first—I mean, I know you mentioned this before—but when you first spoke to him about the movie, you had thought of him more as the villain, the cult leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as a fan, you know, I thought it would be interesting to see him play a character like that. I felt like it had been a while since he'd played an antagonist, and it's funny because I said to him, like he brought it up yesterday. I said to him, this character Jeremiah Sand is the California Klaus Kinski. And he said to me, I am the California Klaus Kinski.
Yeah, I love it. Wonderful.
And I was like, in my mind, I was like, yeah, that's exactly why I want you to play the fucking part, dude.
Because you already are, yeah.
But, you know, so I was so fixated on the idea of him playing the villain that when he expressed interest in playing the exact opposite of that, I had to take a minute to think about it, you know. But yeah, weeks later, it might have been even months later, I had a dream that I was watching a portion of Mandy, the film completed, starring Nicolas Cage, and it was mesmerizing and undeniable.
Oh, interesting. So it wasn't anything he had to show you that he had other character.
No, yeah. I had this dream. Yeah, you know, my id thought better of my decision.
Well, yeah, you would have felt bad leaving Nick Cage out of this movie.
Yeah, so. When I went back and started considering that after seeing that dream, I just realized that I'd been too sort of closed-minded and had blinders on with this idea of him playing the villain. And yeah, I mean, I was going to go a bit younger with Red, but I realized, you know, yeah. And he says that when I saw him at that hotel, he was wearing like long gray beard. He had long gray hair and he looked like 10, you know, 15 years older than he actually is. And then I feel like in the movie, he looks like, you know, he can age down pretty
easily. Yeah, he does, especially with the metal. When they meet for the first time, the scene where they look at each other, he feels, I don't know, he feels young to me.
Yeah, and
it's a great scene. Yeah.
It's easy to forget how metamorphic actors can be, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, once I was, you know, it was sort of like once my mind had opened to the idea of him playing the villain or the hero, I embraced it completely. And was like overjoyed that I had this opportunity to do that. I realized that it was going to, you know, imbue this character with dimensions it never would have had before.
But then you have to match him. You need somebody who can actually go toe to toe with Cage, which isn't an easy ask.
No. That was maybe the hardest part to cast because we had to use European actors, and you know, in the West Coast of North America, there's literally thousands of Jeremiah Sands, and a lot of them happen to be actors.
I believe it.
So you know, you just throw a rock and you'll hit a Jeremiah Sand.
Yeah.
But in Europe, it turns out that somebody who has that kind of feel about them or can capture that feel or understands that feeling is somewhat rare. You know.
Oh, where was the shot? So it was shot in Europe?
It was shot in Belgium.
Oh, okay, that's why. Wow. So you had to fulfill a quota of.
Yeah, we had to quote up on our European.
Yeah.
And I talked to Linus for a few minutes, and he had sort of he had experiences in his life that gave him an innate understanding of what this character was about.
Mm.
That happened in America, and
interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it's an unexpected performance. I've seen him in smaller roles where and even seeing him in person, he just looks so kind of clean cut and straight laced and British. But then seeing he really just embodies this character. And when I'm comparing it to Richard Lynch and God Told Me, I really mean it. Like he goes all the way with it, and it's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's and he's quite hypnotic too. Like any good cult leader, you want them to draw you in. They have to have charm. They can't be charmless. But it starts in such a Last House on the Left almost vibe, the opening of the film.
And how we're seeing the two groups, one traveling. And it feels very Last House on the Left.
There was a point in the film where we had to cut our lighting rig below what we wanted, and so I was like, well, we're just going to go Last House on the Left then. It's just going to be a floodlight on them.
Nice.
was it Super 16 or something? Because it has that nice grainy quality
grain
at the start.
It's actually Arri Alexa.
Oh, okay, nice. Interesting, because it really looks...
Yeah. No, well, we added it in post scans of 35 and 60 millimeter grain of various densities depending on the scene.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, some of them were really, like, I noticed it in the wood cutting scenes at the very beginning. I noticed it a lot more grain.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of a moment because, you know, in the script it says shot on 16 millimeter, and I knew, like, logistically I didn't actually want to shoot the whole movie on 16. I just wanted to shoot the night. I wanted to shoot all the nighttime stuff on the Alexa, but I really wanted to shoot the daytime stuff on anamorphic 16. And then very close to the beginning of a production, the insurance company said that I wasn't allowed to shoot, that they would not underwrite us if we shot on film for whatever reason. And I had a moment there, you know, where I felt like I got kicked in the balls, and I was like, you know, I actually considered for like a day just walking away from the movie because I felt like it was such a fundamental betrayal of what I was trying to do by this random insurance company. But when I thought about it, when I started to analyze it, you know, and realizing that I was actually going to shoot the nighttime stuff on Alexa anyway, and you know, I thought about how I'd seen films that were shot on Alexa and had a fine layer of subtle grain added to them just to give them some texture, like, you know, Skyfall or something like that.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I've started to realize that this the film choice is a very religious thing, and I'm a religious fanatic, you know?
Yeah.
So I decided I'm not going to walk away from the chance to make this crazy ass movie over this, because I know I'll make a beautiful movie either way.
And
a beautiful looking movie.
Especially when our first reaction is, oh, the film grain looks great. So clearly, maybe we just damaged the film's reputation just now. But.
So I want to talk about the bikers. So which was like that. Somebody had told me about like months prior, and it was literally like a, hey, Becca, there's these bikers, but they're like Cenobite bikers, and you're going to love that. And it literally, like, my heart fluttered at that moment. So tell us that, like, it's two moments for me, like a Cenobite and biker.
And you're a big Psychomania fan.
No doubt. Like, that was, like, my jam as soon as the bikers showed up.
Psychomania is prominently – I made a short film, the last short film that I made before Black Rambo. No, actually, that's not true. I made another one after that.
Now I have to see your Psychomania short.
I made a short film, the character in it's watching Psychomania.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That is one I would love to reboot at some point. Yeah. It's like a dream project of mine. But anyways, I want to talk about the bikers because at the same one point, they seem very demonic. Like they don't even have human voices. You make sure never to show them without like full kind of regalia on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they are established as being humans.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about where they came from and how they exist.
In the universe of the film, the thought is that at some point, they pissed off the chemist and he gave them he made them a bad dose of LSD that literally was so toxic and insane that it basically trapped them in a purgatorial hell of being, you know, so high on acid that they're basically like transcending dimensions.
Yeah.
And it's kind of made them into, in a sense, demons. So that was sort of the idea behind them. But again, it was a dream that sort of triggered, really solidified them for me, because I spent a long time sort of dwelling on trying to think, how do I approach these characters in the film? And then I had a nightmare where I was in this weird, old, large, white, painted house, and the only inhabitants were these basically malevolent, like lumbering men that were covered in like black tar.
Huh.
And it was just their presence just oozed malevolence and evil, and it was very terrifying. And I woke up, and as I tend to do, I didn't make the connection. I just went on about my life, and then later I was like, "Holy fuck, that was the Black Skulls!"
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, so I can be a little bit slow to make the connection sometimes when I'm in the middle, when I'm sort of assembling the idea, but it happened in the end, so that's what matters.
Wow. Well, I just know Becca was super excited about some Mexican film that
she
pulled up after the movie, showing us.
Wondering if you'd seen Intrepidos Punks.
No.
Okay, yeah, because there's some of the it's a biker revenge film at the same time.
Oh, cool.
So I was like, it's kind of referencing that, but some of the costuming looks very similar, and was like, I don't even think that film got released in the U.S. Has someone else seen it? I got really giddy.
Well,
she's going to give you a list on the way out.
Yes.
I want to see Intrepidos Punks right now.
It's not as good as it sounds, but you can pull a lot from it. But yeah, The Chemist. So
I was picking up on some kind of godlike allegories there.
He's so like,
good. Say what? Sorry?
I was picking up on godlike allegories, or was that just me?
Well, yeah, because I started looking at these characters as almost like as if they were in a D&D module or in a fantasy novel. You know, Jeremiah's like a wizard, you know, an evil decrepit wizard, and I thought of The Chemist sort of becomes this sort of alchemist, who has this like omniscient, almost weird knowledge of the realm, you know?
And I liked how he was built up. It was like ascending the stairs, and he was in a very white environment. It was very kind of deity like.
The Chemist?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you cast him based on my voice just kind of white godlike. Did you cast him? Because when I saw Rob Zombie's, what was the name of that
31?
One?
31?
When I saw 31, it wasn't – the movie itself wasn't for me at all, but Richard Brake in that film.
Well, my wife, Andrea, who's sitting right there. We were watching 31, and my wife was like, this guy should play The Chemist.
Seriously.
Good call.
Unbelievable in 31. Yeah. Like, he just has this amazing... It's like, to me, that was like witnessing the birth of a star, where you're like, oh my God, who is that?
Yeah.
I want to see... And then he turns out he's in the Game of Thrones as the the thing, whatever you call that.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's fantastic.
And he ended up actually like auditioning, and his audition was so perfect and so on the nose and so innately understood what that character was all about, that every audition after that was just like,
yeah,
it was a joke by comparison, you know?
Yeah, that's cool.
I was so intrigued that his hands are in the acid, like he can touch it.
Yeah, yeah.
And not, like, I don't know if he's feeling the effects or just not at all, but I think that was interesting.
I think, like, the Black Skulls, he's so far gone on it, yeah. But he's, like, in control of his, like, interaction with his mind and the universe, unlike the Skulls who are, like, now, like, spastic, rummaging, you know, night beasts. Yeah,
yeah. Is that an... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, he's what I remember about Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
Yeah. Oh,
he's the cow. And then he says fuck like 25 times in a row.
That's the first time I noticed him as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing character.
Yeah.
He's British, right? So he's part of your quota, right?
Yeah. That's the European quota. That was the happy thing was he's actually doesn't sound British. He just happens to have been born there and then raised here, so he has a British passport.
Now, is there an actual hornet that will fuck you up?
No.
It was a good touch.
Maybe. I mean, maybe if you went down and searched hard enough in the Amazon, you'd find one eventually. But
it was a nice touch.
Do you stay up to date with, like, as horror as a genre? Is it something that you, like, try to catch new films?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you're still a fan.
I mean, it feels like there's less and less that I want to see lately for some reason. I feel like a lot of horror stuff that's being made feels very cheap and kind of careless.
Mm-hmm.
And I just yearn for... You know, when you see something that you know that's been made with care and it stands out, you know.
I feel like every year I'll see like one or two things
yeah.
that fit that, like a kill list or something that surprises me
yes.
where I'm like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yes.
You know, and that's what keeps you interested in this stuff, I think.
We're always looking and hoping
to
find another watchable horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, because I guess you had a longer period between these two films, but like a lot of filmmakers – go on the festival circuit for a long time, right? And meet a lot of other people. Did you ever do that with Beyond the Black Rainbow? Or?
I went to a handful of festivals, but
not to the extent that some people are on for like a year and meet everyone. And
No, I'm not a very sociable person.
Yeah.
You know, I would
this is your first podcast, so obviously.
Yeah. I'm a homebody.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we all are. We're all movie people. Instead of home watching movie people. Do you recall like the last horror film that you really thought, okay, that's something?
That's a really good question. The one that keeps coming to mind is The Invitation.
Okay.
Nice. Oh,
yeah. Karen Kasuma,
yeah. I thought that was an amazing movie.
In terms of last shots, it's where you feel something. Like, oh, shit. There's the whole point of your movie, you know?
A flawless ending. Wonderful movie.
Almost as good as when Nick Cage smiles in your film, but you know. That's not a smiler. A spoiler, me saying Nick Cage smiles, but it is a glorious moment
in
cinema.
It's a brilliant shot.
Yeah.
I just wanted to. I'm a big music guy, and I collect soundtracks on vinyl and CD and all that stuff. Sure. And the music to Beyond the Black Rainbow, terrific. Took me a while to find that record.
I listened to it all.
I wanted to talk because the Mandy score is coming out, mm-hmm. I think, on vinyl and digital through Lakeshore.
Yeah.
At the same time as this movie,
and I think Advaita is putting out a pressing of it as well.
The physical. And unfortunately, I mentioned it before, Johan Johansson is no longer with us, but the work, I mean, the first thing I did after the movie ended last night was go on my phone and see if I could buy the soundtrack immediately.
Right.
And that's always a clear sign of something that stands out and I can't imagine without the film.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, did you know sonically what Mandy was going to be considering how long you lived with the script?
To a degree, you know, but again, like part of the joy of making something is then, you know, interacting with somebody like Johan or Jeremy on Black Rainbow and sort of seeing what they bring to it. It's like with actors in a way, you know, like you have a certain idea, but I don't want to be totally chained to it. I want to be surprised.
Yeah.
I want to feel like I'm discovering something, you know, by working with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like working with an actor, I sort of give, you know, a guideline of what I'm looking for. But if they go outside of that, you know, I'm always kind of open to seeing that and would like to see it, you know. Mm-hmm. So with Johan, my original discussion with him was just that I said it. This is like a rock opera. Mm-hmm. It's a sensorial, you know, visual, sonic experience more than like – I don't want like a score, you know. It's a textural thing. It's an emotional thing, you know. And I think he really responded to that idea. And from talking to him, I realized that he was an Icelandic metalhead, which I didn't know. I had no sense of that from like his work or from, you know, having seen him, admired him from afar. But after talking to him for 15, 20 minutes, I realized that we had a lot more in common than I thought as far as like where we came from, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, are you one of those directors that did you have any music while you were shooting or that you relayed to the actors, or does working with the composer more of a post-production aspect of it?
He came on pretty early, but again, it took a while for him to start to get going, you know, to actually finish some other stuff and then came to work for us. Usually when I'm writing a movie, I will have a playlist of songs that I sort of hone over time, and by the time I'm in pre-production, it'll maybe be down to like 10 songs or something like that, and I'll give it to the actors and I'll give it to the crew, and I gave it to, you know, Johan asked for it just to get a sense of where I was coming from when I was writing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe there was one or two things in that playlist that he used as a sort of reference point, and I know he did specifically use one of them as a reference point, which is a song called Sunday Afternoon in the Park by Van Halen, which has this really amazing synthesizer texture on it that we both loved so much. And, you know, that was kind of like we were both kind of fixated on this synthesizer.
I want to know what else is on the playlist.
I know. I kind of want your Mandy mix.
Well, all the other songs on there are just it's just Call Me Maybe on repeat.
Oh, this is good.
The one other sort of touchstone that we had was the Queen Flash Gordon soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You know, certain textures and elements and kind of vibes from that, but you know, rendered in a more kind of disintegrate-y, dark way. You know.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I just like kind of last thing with genre, like and subgenres, and you know, you kind of sci-fi, horror, the revenge film, but mixed with like you know, Final Fantasy and all sorts of, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. What are some of the subgenres that you're obsessed with? I remember thinking, but with After Hours, I heard you talk to Brian, a friend of mine, about like the Bad Dave film, which is a favorite, subgenre of me, where just everything that can go wrong goes wrong.
Yes.
Well, what are some of the other ones that you kind of obsess over? Not necessarily that you'll ever necessarily make, but that you find yourself drawn to.
I really like the futuristic fascist police state movie.
Oh yeah,
you mean Judge Dredd type?
Judge Dredd, yeah. THX 1138.
Yeah,
but one of my favorite examples of that genre is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh yeah,
because it's a Planet of the Apes movie, but it's also a futuristic fascist police state movie.
Oh yeah, it's shut down at Irvine. Nice. I went to school there for a year, and I was like, "Hey, it's Planet of the Apes."
I used to go to that mall all the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, yeah, no, they're great actually.
Yeah.
So that's one. Any other subgenres?
Gee whiz. Well, the other one is the action horror.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I feel like there could be a lot more of that. There's another – Cobra, like you said, is an action horror film. And of course, Silent Rage, which just the title alone.
Yeah, yeah.
So good.
Pretty good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, people need to discover that if they haven't seen it. It's genuinely a fun movie.
Yeah. But there's another example of the action horror film. But it's not coming to me. Anyways.
Well, that's the fun. That's why I guess I cited Kill List before, because it's a – I don't think it's a bait and switch. It's very organic, but but you are actively watching one genre.
Yeah.
And then something turns and twists, and suddenly you're in a very different world.
Yeah.
And it catches up to it, and it affects – the good ones are connected, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think your, you know, your work definitely is doing that too, especially Mandy, you know, to an extent.
Escape from New York is one that I was considering action horror, because it's not really horror, but because it's Carpenter, it's got that vibe.
As a kid, I thought it was terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, when you first start going down into the tunnels and basements areas of those buildings, and there's those people like lurking in the shadows.
Yeah.
It just like terrified me as a kid. These people, like the people and the weird punks and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like it reminds me of this. There was a Philip K. Dick that was interviewed for like a heavy metal magazine, because he got shown, like before he died, they showed him some scenes or some footage from Blade Runner of like Deckard in the streets of the city, and his takeaway from it was imagine what those people would do to you.
That is terrifying. I'm curious, beyond Black Rainbow and this, were you getting, when people saw Beyond the Black Rainbow, because it came one of those, you know, when movies just come out of nowhere and people are like, whoa, where is that? And that's kind of definition of cult in a sense.
Yeah.
Were people offering you other projects in between, or were you kind of working away?
Really?
I made something that I was proud of, you know? I was like, I made this film that is exactly as I wanted it to be, and I have that. And if I never make another movie again, that's fine. I did the one, and that's all I had to do to die without shame. You know,
yeah. We should all be so lucky,
right?
Yeah. Damn, I wanted stories about how you did like Beyond the Black Rainbow, and then somebody was like, "Do you want to do the next Marvel movie?" Yeah. Like offering you these completely polar opposite projects.
No, nobody offered me shit.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I just kind of I might have put that vibe out too that I didn't want to. Be bothered.
Fuck off, vibe.
Leave me alone.
Leave me alone, vibe. But so then you kind of get to make two projects back to back that are things that were completely your own. Is that something you think you'd be open to in the future? Other projects, or are you going to try to keep?
It depends what it is. You know.
Yeah.
There are certain like existing things that I think it'd be fun to like be able to interpret. You know, kind of like. Spray painting a battleship or something.
Yeah. Well, it's just funny because the 70s, we look at the 70s as our golden period of filmmaking. It was because the people running these movies were getting freedom to make films, personal films like what you're doing. But what's interesting about now, and we get a lot of criticism now about movies, but the one cool thing they're doing is letting people like you or the Ben Wheatleys of the world actually take over major properties.
Right, yeah.
And that can actually lead to some really interesting films that you would never have been able to do before, you know?
Yeah.
So I hope we see something like that, you know.
Well, you know, I look at Cronenberg for example, like going to Hollywood and making The Fly.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
And it's still really subversive.
Yeah,
and romantic. It's like your film has that romance.
And Dead Zone, and they're very much his own films. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're a little bit glossier and more. What's the word for when people like to watch something? Like accessible.
Accessible. Popcorny, plastic,
a veneer.
Hollywood. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you grew up with a Hollywood model, watching Hollywood films being made. So
I love fun movies.
Yeah.
I love to watch them.
Yeah. Well, you made one. I mean, that's the thing. You never know how a mainstream audience is going to interpret any movie and also the crowd we start with. But to me, it has a mixture of like real art and entertainment. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's sweet. It's
funny because my friend said that he was reading through the reviews and that literally every single one of them included the sentence, not for everybody.
Well, hopefully. You'd hope so. Because if you make something for everyone, it's probably shit.
It's going to be really vanilla.
I will thank you. No, I was going to say, I do watch – he doesn't watch trailers at all for movies.
Yeah, I didn't see the trailer to this. I stayed away from it.
I did, and as soon as I saw the trailer, and I'll thank you here in person, I was like, I didn't know how desperately I needed Nicolas Cage with a chainsaw in my life until I saw it.
Yeah.
When I saw that moment, I was like, oh, yeah, I needed that. I was missing that. Yeah. So thank you for giving him a chainsaw.
You're very welcome.
And this will actually be in normal theaters, or is this like limited?
It's playing in some theaters.
This will be Friday. This comes out Friday.
There's a bunch of stuff. It's like there's some theaters where it's going to be playing a normal opening
run,
and then there's a whole slew of like one night only screenings,
like draft houses,
Thursdays on Thursday night.
Okay, cool,
nice.
And wait, this Thursday or next Thursday?
This Thursday. Last night.
This airs on Friday, September 14th. So Mandy's out now. Yeah.
Then all the digital masters are going to be magnetically wiped.
Like the end of Escape from L.A. Great ending.
Now, when does this go to VOD?
I believe almost immediately.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's day and date. It's day and date. Today. You can watch it.
But we don't want you to.
Yeah, you guys need to go to the theaters to see this one. There's too much happening to watch this.
Like, what
on
the fuck,
iPod.
Kevin Smith? Kevin Smith opens the Q&A last night saying he watched it on his phone or some shit.
It wasn't playing theatrically. No, he didn't have the opportunity.
Like, Kevin, come on, dude. Like, all right.
They may have asked him yesterday morning. Who knows?
Okay.
Yeah,
it's totally fine.
That was shocking to me. I was like, come on. Where's David Lynch with his not on a fucking iPhone commercial?
Well, you know, they may not have been able to rent a theater for him to watch.
Stop making excuses for Kevin Smith.
While you guys yell at Kevin Smith.
Yeah. We have a lot of issues to work through. Now, he was looking good.
We love you, Kevin. He was great last night. Mandy's out right now in theaters and VOD. Try to see on the big screen because it's better that way and it's fucking loud.
It's a sonic rock experience, you know. And we advised all the theaters to turn it up to the maximum potential.
Oh, yeah, well, look,
Elric wore his Thriller Killer shirt just for you.
For you today.
Thank you.
Uncomfortable fucking material, but I was like, I'll wear this shirt.
I didn't want to be presumptuous and be like, I thought that's a great shirt.
It was for you.
Yeah.
It's all for you.
Your music was way better than that band in the Thriller Killer.
That's true. But it didn't have the buffalo painting.
It didn't have a buffalo painting. I asked that at trivia a couple of months ago, and now I can't even remember the answer. What was the name of the band in Driller Killer?
Oh, fuck. That's something.
The Roosters?
Yeah, it's the Roosters.
It's the Roosters. Okay.
Talk about a tangent.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. We hope your first podcast was pleasant enough that you'll do more.
And
I mean, nobody's making movies like you right now, man. So please keep making more.
I'll try.
Remember, you already died once, so this is all bonus now.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.